The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hello, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition. This week, we're going to continue on with our dialogue series that we do every quarter. And for those of you not familiar, the dialogue series is where we kind of feature listeners' comments, feedback on how they're planning their own retirements, maybe using some elements of what we talk about on the show, how we plan for our clients' retirements. And I think it's kind of fun to share what other people are doing and the variations and kind of adjustments that they make, the little bit they might take from us and the little bit that they take from other places, and kind of bundle it together in their own do-it-yourself approach to retirement planning. So today we're going to do a little bit more of that. One more time, I'll give you a heads up that next week we will either be doing more dialogue series, or we might have the opportunity to have Paul, which is one of the CPAs that works with us, in to talk a little bit about some tax topics, which are timely this time of the year. But also this time of the year, he's busy doing tax returns as well. So there's a possibility we're going to have some time to grab him and do that. So next week will be either that or more dialogue series if he's just not able to do it. So we will find out. He actually pretty religiously listens to the show here, so hopefully Jim will reach out to him before he just hears randomly on here that that he's invited. Maybe we give him an official invite first.
Well, it's funny. Hi, folks. This is Jim. So welcome to the EDU version of the Retirement and IRA Show. And thanks for that kind of handoff, Chris. But you made me smile on this. Let me give our listeners a little background. When Chris and I tell you, or when I especially tell you, this show is totally unscripted, and we sometimes have no idea what we're going to talk about until literally the minute I sit down at the microphone. I'm not making that up. And honestly, if I can't talk for an hour to sometimes an hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes about a concept of what I do, I shouldn't be doing what I do. And that's why I refuse to have a script. But it's also a wonderful way to communicate with staff, because they listen to Chris and I, especially the three taxeteers, which is the cute little euphemism I call our tax team, the three taxeteers. Nice. See how I see that's a play on words, Chris? Could you figure that out?
I kind of see that. And he's also springing that on me. I've never heard him utter that phrase before.
I uttered it last week.
I didn't hear that. I've never heard you say the three taxeteers.
Do you not pay attention
not to every word you say?
Apparently not.
No, I get a little overloaded, so I have to kind of selectively.
The three taxeteers. You got to admit, that's kind of cute. We have Paul, Steve, and Alan, or Alan, Paul, Steve in the order that they were hired. But irrespective, they all listen to the podcast. And today, Tuesday, is our group meeting day. And we do planning. All planning at my firm is done on a group level. Even though we all pride ourselves in our knowledge and feel we are fairly knowledgeable, nobody unilaterally comes up with a strategy without first running it by the group. I just feel that is incredibly important. And I think you'll agree, Chris, and listeners in general, if you're involved in these types of brain sessions in your work, I got the idea from, honestly, and I know I'm rambling here, but years ago when the CU medical system, it used to be called PVH in the past, if you remember, Chris, then it merged with Colorado University. The CU medical system was building a cancer center in Fort Collins off of Harmony. I was involved in that. I served on the volunteer board where we would lend our opinion and help raise money. And I was very involved in that years and years ago. So they gave us a tour of the facility as it was under construction. And I hope it's a facility I never have to use. But it's nice knowing it's there right in Fort Collins. And one of the rooms they took us to, if memory serves me correct, had no windows, had tables all very close to each other, and a big screen that was going to allow things to be flashed on it. And they explained to us that that's where the physicians would meet, I don't know how often, to review their patient cases with other physicians just to make sure that they were on the right track. Mm-hmm. And it always, and I might be explaining that wrong, if there's physicians watching, you can set me straight, but that was my understanding of what that room was intended for. And they explained to us, I don't know if every physician was involved in it, but it was just where they could go and say, hey, I have a patient here, they're this age doing this, and here's their situation, and here's what I think we should be doing. And I knew at that point, that's where I wanted to take our firm. So that said, we do that on Tuesdays, folks. And today, we only had two CPAs, two of the taxateers. Paul was not on it, and it was Alan and Steve. And do you remember? They both listened to the podcast and shared with us that they were shocked that Paul was going to come on the show this Friday for the Q&A because they don't understand with all the busyness and tax prep how Paul agreed to that. And I had to tell him it was Paul's idea. It was not us.
But we might be pushing our luck to have him also do an EDU show.
That's, we will. So part of what we're going to ask Paul, folks, and Paul, if you're listening, be prepared. We're going to ask you on Friday. If he has enough time to not just record the Q&A show dedicated to taxes, will he do an EDU show dedicated to taxes? That we got one email question. This, we got several. We got enough email questions on taxes after I put the call out to keep Paul busy for an hour easily. But one of the questions was trying to explain cap gains and how they work and how they stack on top of regular income and how to figure out if you're going to be in the zero cap gain bracket or not. And just, it's a good question. So I was telling Chris, you know, that's an answer that can go much, much longer, but maybe not to take a full EDU. So the second part of what I would like to do with Paul, if he's listening, is answer this listener's question for the first 30 minutes on cap gain taxes and how they stack and how cap gains stack on regular income and how to figure everything out. Then dive a little bit deeper into the wash sale rule, because there's a lot of uniqueness to the wash sale rule that a lot of people don't think of. And I have an outline and a little, Paul, if you're listening, and an article that kind of walks through a lot of what I want to cover, and I'll send that to you ahead of time. Chris, you don't get that pleasure, but Paul does. But I'll send it to you too, Chris, just in case. Okay. So if Paul agrees and can somehow, in the middle of tax prep season, find time to record two shows, the Q&A and the EDU, we will definitely have Paul on next Tuesday for a tax-dedicated EDU. If not, we'll bring him on after tax prep. So anyways, that's how that all came up today, is that often our three taxateers who are all retired CPAs, believe it or not, all podcast listeners.
Not super retired because they're still doing work.
I was going to say they're not uberly. I mean, they're retired, I guess, but they also still love doing this, and they're all podcast listeners, and they like our approach. They knew our approach. They reached out to us. They've been a wonderful fit, I think, and they work great together, and they each have their own little niches. And I think combined, we're talking over 60, 70 years of tax experience. So been a wonderful addition to the firm. We obviously let them set their own hours and work all work remotely and very flexibly because they are also retired, just like listeners are trying to get to retirement, just like yours truly will someday be retired to one degree or another. Okay, so today, though, we're going to continue with our dialogue series. Next week, we'll either continue with dialogue or surprise you with Paul doing an EDU on cap gains and wash sale. So before we jump in, we actually received a follow-up email, folks, from the gentleman whose email we had been featuring on our dialogue series. Before I get to that, I got a quick little PSA, if you will. And I'm going to just read it. It's just a quick little PSA, and you can give your thoughts. I'll give mine. I just wanted to acknowledge this person reaching out to us with his thoughts. But what really strikes me, Chris, have you noticed in what's our email program called? Don't tell me. It's from Microsoft. It's the 360. No, it's 360 Outlook. Mm-hmm. Did you notice in Outlook? So I just opened up his email. I guess Microsoft is reading it, and it probably picked up on the word instead of, and then he explains what he means. But it actually gives me some reasonable answers that I could easily click as a reply, and off it goes. Have you noticed it started doing that? Mm-hmm. It's kind of eerie that it's reading our emails, but the replies are kind of accurate based on what this gentleman wrote. I'm floored by artificial intelligence, and I hope it's used for good, even though sadly, and we'll feature some shows on this, it can be used for bad, especially as we age and become more gullible. And I've been sharing that with Chris just recently at the firm and what we as a firm are going to do to help protect our clients. But have you noticed the AI answers, if you will, in Outlook, or is that just me noticing it?
I don't think... I don't use the latest version of Outlook. There's like a new version that has a few of those things in it. And that new version took away some things that I use. So I haven't pulled the trigger on it. I'm looking at my Outlook right now in the upper right-hand corner, and I still have the new version turned off. So once they deal with the issues I had when I tried it several months ago, I'll turn it back on and see that probably. But mine does not do that.
Right, because it says you may want to start your reply with, and it always gives you three choices. And if I click it, it will put those words in my reply right away at the beginning, give me the ability to send it if I'm happy with it or add more to it. And it just, again, amazes me that it's reading the email and coming up with that. But it also makes you wonder, are they just reading it? Are they storing it anywhere? And it starts to get... little crazy, but it's very amazing what artificial intelligence is starting to do. Okay, that said, he lives in a state, Chris, he gave a quick little hint. I never knew this. This state's motto is Excelsior.
Just the word?
That's what he says. The motto is one word. Again, we don't vet these. Excelsior.
I have no idea.
And well, he gives a definition. He says, in case you don't know, Excelsior means ever upward.
Doesn't help.
Okay. Then he gives one more joke. He said, from my state, I think they're referring to their income taxes. And then he puts a little smiley face. So it's obviously a high-tax state. So it's narrowing it down for you.
Massachusetts.
Good guess. No, New York. Excelsior. But he says maybe referring to income taxes. little smiley face. Okay, he says, I really enjoy your podcast and I learn a lot from it. But while listening to a recent show, I suddenly had this thought. Instead of using always taxable, maybe taxable, and never taxable as your three types of accounts, I think it would be clearer and more accurate if you started calling them always taxable, maybe taxable, and already taxed. Just a thought for your consideration. I appreciate the thought, listener, and that's why I'm putting it in the dialogue. It's just the dialogue between us. I think I'll stay with never taxable. First of all, it kind of flows better. Always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable.
His is more accurate, I'd say, though, if we really think about it, because what we call never taxable has been taxed. There was tax. It's not like
part of it has been. The money going in, the growth was never taxed.
True.
So it's just, to me, it flows better. Always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable. I understand what you're saying, and I understand what you're agreeing with, Chris. Already taxed, but it doesn't flow as smooth. Always taxable, maybe taxable, already taxed. It just doesn't flow as smooth as always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable. And for those who don't understand, it's my way of just trying to get people to understand some accounts, the distributions will always, and we're talking income taxes, will always be subject to income taxes, IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, TSPs, 457s, things like that. Granted, we can see there can be some basis in them, but for the most part, distributions will always be subject to taxes. Then there's accounts, brokerage accounts, that may be taxable, not may space be taxable, but may, well, I guess you could do it both ways. Maybe is the word, M-A-Y-B-E, maybe, or may be with a space between. We can go either way because they may be taxable to you. And if, as Paul will explain on cap gains discussion, it all is going to depend what your income is in any given year on whether or not the distributions from a brokerage account will be taxable to you or not. They may also generate income taxes. They may generate capital gains taxes. It may be taxable. And then never taxable is just a simple way of explaining the distributions from those accounts, if they're qualified. And for 99.9% of retirees, they will easily hit the qualification. If they're a qualified distribution, you will not pay income taxes on it. And those two main accounts are Roths and HSAs. So we put them in the never taxable. I just find it easier than the industry, I don't even know anymore because I always say always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable. But the industry uses different jargon, and I found some people don't understand the industry jargon, but they definitely understand always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable. Yeah. So anyways, nice dialogue, but I do think I will stick with the way that I do it. If you want to add anything you can to this gentleman.
No, that's good. I liked his suggestion, his thought process. If we were coming up from scratch, we certainly would have, I think, considered that. But I do think it rolls off the tongue a little better the way you do it.
All right. So let's get into the gentleman who we've been featuring on the podcast. So he wrote back to us, folks, and he sent us a nice email. And he wanted to kind of dialogue, give us a little bit of feedback. If you don't know anything about this guy's situation, go listen to the last two EDU shows. We talk about his email quite a bit. So I'm just going to assume everybody has listened and we don't need to get deep into it. So he begins, Chris. He says, hi, Jim and Chris. Thanks so much for featuring how I modified my minimum dignity floor and fund number strategy on your dialogue series. And I think you'll agree, Chris, he did modify it, but stayed close to it, but modified it. I appreciate all your comments and the other ideas for me to consider. I will definitely think long and hard about annuitizing my mortgage. Even though I was expecting the secure income to help cover the future shortfall of our minimum dignity floor after the mortgage is paid off, I do like your idea of trying to arbitrage the mortgage, since it is at such a low interest rate, and they will go on till such a late age. I believe his interest rate, Chris, was 3, and it's not paid off till 85, and I think he was only in his 60s.
Sounds
Anything
right.
you want to add? I know you. This was kind of a thorn in the side of
you. Just quick recap why we kind of recommend a direction more like that rather than annuitizing is that when you annuitize, the real intention there, at least in our eyes, is to have lifetime income to cover a lifetime obligation. And a mortgage, if it's going to pay off within your conceivable lifetime, is not a forever expense that goes on like other minimum dignity floor expenses. So we're reluctant to annuitize to cover it. Plus, I always feel a little queasy about enriching two financial institutions when I could just cut out the middleman and deal with it. And by that, I mean giving money to an insurance company to annuitize while also giving interest to a mortgage company just for them to pay each other. You know, essentially, that's what's going on. It just seems weird. Now, I know the numbers can work out where you could maybe make a mathematical or financial argument that that makes sense, but that just at its face bothers me. But finally, you know, I think because it's a finite obligation, at some point it's going to be paid off, use a finite commitment to pay it. And that's where that arbitrage comment comes from, where if you set aside the money and earmark it for satisfying the mortgage and you're able to earn more safely on that money than what your mortgage costs you, then you get a little bit ahead, right? The old idea that if I can earn 5%, but my mortgage only costs me 3%, I'm getting ahead of the game. You have to be really careful with that concept, though, because a lot of people are ignoring the difference in risk between those things. And I just want to mention that. I don't want to turn this into a whole thing about that concept, but it's, you know, don't assume you can earn 12% on your money while paying a 3% mortgage, because you're definitely comparing a risk-free option of paying off your mortgage with a very risky option of pursuing 12% or some much higher number. So,
but as we mentioned when we were chatting about this, Chris, right now on safe money,
right,
he can arbitrage it,
right, and that's why this has come up again. Back 5 years ago, we didn't talk about this because there was really no arbitrage opportunities that were nice and clean arbitrage at reasonable risk levels. But now, because interest rates have changed and you're lucky to be locked into a long-term low interest rate, as interest rates go up, that empowers you to arbitrage in a safe way.
Absolutely. And he doesn't have to arbitrage. I think he has 20 plus years before this mortgage is paid for. You could put in safe money right now. You can still get CDs paying more than 3%. So he could arbitrage the safe money with 1 year CDs, or you can get even a 3-year MIGA. We just ran a quote for a gentleman on a 3-year MIGA, 5.65% interest for 3 years, guaranteed. He can build in some very safe money with some good arbitrage right there. But the longer term money, the money that he's going to use to pay off the mortgage 10, 12, 15, 20, 20 plus years from now, he could invest those dollars. He could even use one of the buffered ETF products we talk about with a 10, 20, or even 30% downside protection, just to remove the emotional fear that those longer term dollars are at risk. Generally, the reference asset would be the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ 100. Those are the more common buffered ETFs that he could find. This isn't a recommendation. He has to do his own due diligence and figure these products out. Don't just take my word for it. But right now, the cap rates on those products are, depending on if you're getting a 10, 20, or 30% downside buffer, are still around 18%, obviously on the lower 10% buffers, all the way to about 11, 10, 11% on a 30% buffer in any given 12-month period. That's substantially higher than the 3% he's going to pay with downside protection from an emotional standpoint. So that's all we were sharing with him, and he's sharing back with us that he might research that. And that's what you guys need to do. Don't just listen to Chris and I blindly. Do your own research. Take some of our thoughts and say, hey, let me research that. Let me see if I like that idea. So anyways, that was that. Then he continues, and this is going straight to you, Chris. Mm. Since sending my original email, I did realize I am missing my buffer. So thank you. And I added another $250,000 to be carved out for my buffer. Perhaps it should be even higher based on Chris's comment stating that I should allocate 10 to 15% of my overall nest egg using his numbers on my $3.5 million. Maybe I should allocate $350,000 to $525,000. I kind of want you to chat about this for two reasons. I need to run and go get a drink. But number two, I don't think that's a hard and fast rule.
Right.
That was more of a suggestion you were making. But why don't you chat a little about that? Because it was you who pointed out to him he built no buffer into his analysis.
Right. So as Jim was kind of walking through his previous original email, he'd identified all the common set-asides and addressing all these factors of the minimum dignity floor and the delay period and these types of things, aging LTC, I think, was even factored in there in some way. But when the email was said and done, there was no mention of a what we call a reserve buffer in-house. And this is our, in our approach or concept, we like to address as much of the future as we can directly that we feel we can likely reasonably forecast our events that could face a retiree and come up with plans or strategies to address those things, but then admit there's things that happen that we just couldn't maybe anticipate, that maybe we didn't build in the right assumptions for inflation, or we didn't anticipate some new earth-shattering change to the economy that comes out, or something that affects them personally, some uniquely personal, sometimes people call them black swan events even, but there's all kinds of things, not as rare as black swans, but stuff that isn't oftentimes directly addressed in most retirement planning. And so we like to admit that those things can happen and recommend that people put a contingency fund together for these things that it doesn't have as direct of a need, as we point out, for long-term minimum dignity floor, or for aging, or a pre-funded inheritance, or some of those other things we talk about regularly, but rather here's an umbrella over all this stuff of some money that's there just in case we were off about something or something completely surprises us. And we talk about this, and most people find that that's a good idea, and but they have trouble coming up with a number. So the only reason I threw out the 10 to 15% is just having worked with hundreds of retirees in the past and letting them come up with their number, which we have to admit is not something we can calculate because it's for something that we couldn't even anticipate happening maybe. I don't know how you calculate that. And so there's no mathematical approach to coming up with the right number. So we encourage people to put aside enough that will make them sleep better at night, knowing that it's there, feeling comfortable that they've got a reasonable set of extra insulation above all the other things that we've planned for. This isn't the only protection. This is like that last extra layer of protection. And what I found over the years is people were usually kind of settling on this 10 to 15% dollar amount to make them sleep better at night. And so I share that with people who ask, who say, oh, well, I have no idea how even to come up with a number. And so I tell them, you know, a lot of people end up in the 10 to 15% range. But this is very personal, very unique to each person. And so it is really, what do you need to sleep fine at night? And you could certainly factor in how, you know, maybe you have a lot of secure income that covers not just your minimum dignity floor, but most of your fun expenses. I would consider that situation to be a little bit different than someone who's got just mostly assets that they're distributing in order to cover things. And, or, you know, just the variables that are unique to you, you certainly could contemplate. But again, if you're searching for a way to calculate what this number should be, I think that's a fool's errand. I just don't think that's going to happen. So just concentrate on what's going to make me sleep well at night. And if putting together 250, like he mentioned, which is less than my 10 to 15 suggestion, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. As long as he thinks, looking at his whole situation, that an extra 250 as insulation is enough for him, I think he's probably fine. I wouldn't expect him to feel bad about not reaching the 350 level, which is, I think, where he'd need to be to get 10%. But it's really what it's all about. Just reasonable protections that help you sleep well at night, dedicated to a purpose we couldn't even identify.
Right. When I came up with the concept of this buffer, as a toy coming out of the toy box, or as dollars coming out of your see-through portfolio, to continue with our metaphor, it was intended solely, folks, as an emotional number. I like to think that our secure retirement income process, the whole approach we take, which again will be discussed in detail in the next 7, 8, 9, 10 EDU shows going forward after next week. If you're a new listener, you'll be hearing it all. But the intent, and I always tell people, is a purely emotional number. I like to think the security time and income process helps overcome your reluctance to spend on fun, because it's going to freak you out when you retire. It is. It's going to freak me out, and I do this for a living. If it doesn't freak you out, you either have more money than you conceivably can need, or you just got a strong constitution, as they say. But for most people, it's going to feel weird not getting a paycheck anymore, and instead watching your portfolio drop. That's what's going to freak you out the most. Even if you have enough money, it's just going to freak you out. To help overcome that, I came up with the concept of the see-through portfolio and the fun number to show you. You've got all of these other elements covered, or at least covered to the best we can project, or the best you can project, for what is known at that time. It's etched in jello, not in stone. These can change. But when you can see that, you hopefully will feel more comfortable spending on fun. So the buffer is an emotional number. I tell people there's no right or wrong answer to it. It's whatever makes you feel comfortable. Remember, Chris, and I believe, and I know I'm right on this. There was a couple, and the woman wanted $1 million in her buffer. Do you remember that?
Vaguely. This was a while ago.
And I may remember it more because it has to do on the investing side. They also happen to be an asset management client of ours. And you know, and if you're an asset management client, you definitely know, I'm very involved in the asset management because I'm training Jacob. And I've been training Jacob for over 2.5 years now. And I'm ready to push that bird out of the nest. He's not going to need me on meetings anymore. He's doing phenomenal. And Jacob, if you're listening, you truly are doing phenomenal. So I know that it was the biggest buffer I think we ever had to date. And the smallest buffer was 50,000. So that's a big window, folks.
Yeah.
50,000 and a million. There's no right or wrong answer. For the $50,000 person, that worked perfect for them. And for the $1 million person, that worked perfect for them. It's an emotional number designed to help you feel comfortable spending on fun. It comes directly from your fun number. Mm-hmm. So you're willing to pull out of fun. You're willing on the seesaw. Remember, on the left is the current you. On the right is the older you. The fulcrum, the metal bar, is your retirement plan. So on the seesaw, you're helping the older you go up. What's going to happen to the younger you? It's going to go down. The younger you is willing to reduce their fun number to reserve more to the older you. There's no right or wrong answer on this. I'm just glad this gentleman is building a buffer in, because it also does solve not only an emotional issue, it does solve a very real risk. You can only spend a dollar once. And if you spend a lot of dollars on fun, If you needed them later for something that we can't even imagine, COVID is the most common one we reference now. Nobody saw a pandemic coming from a Chinese laboratory and spreading throughout the world. Nobody saw that coming. Nobody knew. You can't predict everything. Who knows what the future is going to bring? And maybe the older you is going to sit there and say, gosh, I had one hell of a great time spending on fun, but my God, could I really use an extra $300,000 right now for this issue? So it's true. It solves a financial risk as well, but the purpose was more emotional, but I think it also solves a financial risk. Okay, let's continue with what he says. This also, Chris, will relate to you because Chris does this particular calculation that he's going to reference in a minute. He does this all the time. And this gentleman didn't realize until later, Chris, he made a mistake in his calculations. He says, another thing I realized after my original email went out is that I used the age 70 dollars that I will need to purchase an annuity. I did not discount them down now. So he goes on to say, the great thing is when I discounted those dollars down now, and I don't know what discount rate he uses. I'm going to let you explain all this. He said the difference came to $250,000. So I just earmarked that to my buffer reserve. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he continues, I know I will tweak my plan many, many more times before I actually pull the trigger on my retirement, but you have given me plenty to think about. Why don't you share what he meant by the discounting down? That the numbers that we were using, I thought they were the discounted. They were the actual age $70. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens, folks, when he discounted it down, his quote-unquote savings turned out to pretty much equal what he had decided to put for his buffer. So it's kind of a non-issue for him dollar-wise. He just kind of changed the calculation. What does he mean he never discounted it down?
So where that comes into play is whenever you're taking into consideration a need in the future, when you're starting retirement, for instance, where it comes into play for us, we take a look at what available resources people have on day one of retirement, and we start breaking it up into these pieces, if you will, these reserves for certain things, which led us to the concept of the see-through portfolio. But when we're looking at a need that's maybe later at 70, I think he was 62 or something like that. He was younger. So that means there's 8 years before he has this need. In his case, it was a need to generate more secure income to protect his long-term minimum dignity floor. But the what it's for isn't that important as to what the dollars are expected to be needed to satisfy that need or goal that you have down the road. And if it's 8 years in the future, I think it's reasonable to expect that you're not going to put that money in a box under your bed and it's going to earn zero. So you'd have to reserve the whole amount that you need in 8 years, but rather assume that you can earn some reasonable rate of return between now and the year that you need it. In my example, 8 years from now. So discounting is a way of factoring that in, essentially reducing the dollar amount that you need, recognizing that you're going to earn your assumed rate of return, whatever that might be. I'm not going to name one because that's something unique to the situation and unique to your particular situation, your particular risk tolerance and things like that. And but that's the process. And so if you need X amount in 8 years, you're going to need something less than X amount as a reserve set aside today if you're assuming that you can earn a rate of return over that 8 years. And that's that method of discounting your dollars back to today and where it plays a part in the approach he's using and we're using, because we're trying to figure out what do we need to set aside for this, that, and the other thing today so that we know how much of today's portfolio might be available for things like fun. That's where the fun number comes from.
Exactly. And that's what he ends with. He says, I'm now gaining traction on getting my wife on board with the idea of secure income to cover a minimum dignity floor, and to actually spend more on our fun through our fun number early in retirement. We're already starting to feel more aches and pains in our body and can understand how important it is to spend a good portion of our fun number early in retirement. We use the phrase go-go phase, folks, early in retirement, while we can still enjoy our young grandchildren. Life is too short. I think he ends, that's his end of his email. Well, he ends with, best of both of you, thanks for what you do. He captures the essence of what I was trying to do. I've shared with you the stories behind the fun number. I will share again in the upcoming EDU series. This wasn't in a textbook. I didn't read and learn about it at Boston University. I think it played well into my personality, which I shared with you as Frank Santos, the R-rated hypnotist, explained to me, and that will be in our EDU series if you don't know what I'm talking about. But also the observation that I was taught as a police officer, and the fact that as a cop, every day when I was working, and back then I was in my 20s, and I pulled as much OT as I could. So I was working nearly every day, seriously, on the police force. I had no girlfriend. And even when I had one, I still worked a lot. It's probably why we're not together. But I was in my 20s and I loved it. I was full of testosterone and that's what I did. And I met the other guy every day. And we all know nothing bad's going to happen to us. It's always going to be the other guy. And that's great. It's a great self-defense mechanism humans have. But the reality is sooner or later, you will be the other guy. And I think it was a conflation. I don't know if that's the correct word. Chris will correct me. But a conflation of all these different things that caused me to come up with this approach to retirement planning. But the intent always was to get you to understand, and Chris agrees, and it might be one of the reasons he stuck it out with me. I'm not the easiest person in the world, and I know that. I take this job so seriously, and I have a passion for it. I can be difficult at times in the office, but my staff accept, at least I hope they accept it, and they understand this is Jim's baby. This is what we're trying to do. And he believed enough in it to stick it out with me through the good and the bad, because he always shared with me at the back of his mind, he never understood this notion of a quote unquote safe withdrawal rate, that underspending on fun was as big as a failure as outliving your assets. And that this whole notion of the safe withdrawal rate was just telling you, spend much less money than you need to. I don't get that. I truly don't. Because if you cover the expenses that will last for the rest of your life, whether you have money or not, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, with lifetime guaranteed streams of income, Social Security, pension, and yes, the godforsaken four-letter word, in retirement, in annuity, but if you knew those expenses were taken care of, or at least taken care of to the extent they can be without having a crystal ball, it's going to make spending on fun easier once you address aging, pre-funded inheritance, and buffer. I always wanted to structure it this way because I always felt, and sadly, I can share stories, and I will, using complete privacy, but real stories of real people who never made it. Never made it out of their 60s, let alone their early 70s, and never got to enjoy the retirement that they wanted. But at least I hope that if they could say down from heaven, or hopefully not up from hell, or whatever it is you believe happens to us at our deaths. I don't know. Y'all have your own beliefs. Hopefully they would share that, hey, I at least spent more than I don't want to say more than they thought, because they spent what they felt comfortable, but at least they spent more than the quote-unquote 4% that people would say you can only spend. And even though they passed away much, much, much sooner, they got to enjoy that little bit of time because we don't have an expiration date on our foreheads. And that's my whole issue with the safe withdrawal rate. They apply it to fun. And fun, as this gentleman said, he's already feeling the aches and pains in his body. I feel the aches and pains in my damn body. And I'm 60 now. I hate saying that. But I'm kidding you not, folks. I feel it. I can hike pretty far. But I can't garden as much as I used to. The up, the down, the bend, the over, the this, the that. I feel it. I feel in the morning getting out of bed. I'm not the same man. Not the same man I was 20 years ago. And I know eventually something's going to, I will be the other guy. I almost was. You all know I nearly died 3 years ago. I should be dead. We all say that. And I should be, but I didn't die. But I know someday either I will or something's going to happen where maybe I'm not going to be hiking and hunting and fishing and gardening as much as I do. I intend to enjoy those passions while I can. And I don't want to be fixated on some stupid safe withdrawal. That's too harsh of a word. A lot of people do like the safe withdrawal rate and it works for them. I just happen to be passionate that you should spend as much as possible on fun without hurting the older you. Yes, without hurting the older you. But without unnecessarily constraining your fun in this misguided notion that you need to spend the same amount on fun, 4%, every year, now until you die. It doesn't acknowledge that your ability to do fun things is degrading, and it's degrading much faster than we want to admit. And I get it. It's always going to be the other guy, never you. You won't have the stroke or the dementia diagnosis, or the Alzheimer's, or the heart attack, or the trip and fall, or get diagnosed with a compressed spine. This happened to someone recently, I won't share who, and all of a sudden, their ability to sit in their tractor has been greatly reduced and ride their horses. No, this is not a client of mine, this is a friend of mine. And they're going through this notion that, my God, I can't do it anymore. And I always wanted to. And it hit them like a ton of bricks. These are real issues. And Chris, you shared with me, that's one of the reasons I think that you stuck with me through thick and thin, is you understood and you too felt that under the safe withdrawal rate, telling somebody 8, 9, 10 years into retirement, you could have spent more, rubs you the wrong way, does it not?
Yeah, because at that point, it's in a lot of cases too late. And it's almost worse to find out then, because it is actually very common. A lot of the guardrail approaches and other things, there's this notion that 8 to 10 years in, you're going to get notified, oh, things are going better than planned. You're on the positive side of the distribution here. So you can spend a little more. Congratulations. If that was the phone call I got from an advisor, as I'd been underspending apparently for a while, I would, if I was plenty healthy, I guess it wouldn't bother me. But I think the chances that you have degraded and you just can't physically do a lot of the things that you could have done 10 years prior, that's a real chance, a real possibility. And for those people, that's, I think, an annoying phone call. Well, thanks. Where were you before? Why couldn't you have figured something out before so I could spend a little bit more rather than it's a little too late, right? That's a fundamental weakness of that approach, I think, is timing, that you don't live forever. A lot of these approaches, I think, ignore the natural progression from 60 to mortality, whatever that age might be. It is a real path, and it's not generally an improvement in your physical ability to do things. It's a somewhat decline, and the decline will be different for different people, but it's going the other direction, not like when you're 20 and you go from 20 to 30 or something and maybe gain the ability to do things. We're on the other side of that curve at this point. And anything that can kind of squeeze a little more juice out of the orange earlier, I think, is valuable, because it just increases the chance that you get to enjoy the juice you know, don't hand me a glass of juice in 10 years when I can't handle it. I can't do anything with it. I just have to pour it out or leave it for someone else to drink. That's essentially what's happening. It's congratulations, you can spend more. Well, you don't do it because now you physically can't go do the things. So it's just extra money that go to beneficiaries. So it's not completely lost. But if your goal was to drink it yourself, you missed out.
Exactly. Don't be the Debbie Downer. And y'all know, if you're a longtime podcast listener, Debbie Downer was a term my dad told me. My dad was in a not assisted living. He was in one of those senior communities. You had to be over 55. Most of the people were in their 70s and 80s, like my dad was at the time. And he shared with me back when he was healthy. Dad, I just chatted with him today. He's doing his best he can. He's going to be 90. Y'all know he went into a nursing home about 8-10 months ago. He definitely, Chris, after chatting with him today, no doubt, if he had LTC, he would now qualify. He can no longer do more than 2 of 6 activities of daily living. It was questionable when he first went in there. I shared with everybody, and I shared that because just because you have LTC insurance doesn't mean it's going to stop paying the second you go into a nursing home. You have to lose the ability to do 2 of 6 or more activities of daily living. Dad is definitely there. But when Dad was doing well, he shared with me long before the nursing home, he shared with me to share with you, listeners. Well, not necessarily listeners, he said clients. He didn't quite understand the concept of a podcast, so I don't explain it to him. But he said, don't let your clients be Debbie Downers. And he shared some of the most depressing people in his senior community weren't people like himself with little in assets. It was actually people who had money, but they didn't have the health anymore to spend it on fun. It took care of them, but that was it. And they always felt, he said, their family's just waiting for them to die to get their money to spend it. The family doesn't come out visiting nearly as often as those people felt they should. But he said, don't let them be Debbie Downers. They're the worst people in here, the people who have regrets. My dad doesn't have much money. Again, I pay for his cable. I send him extra money every month. He doesn't have much money, but he's happy because he has all these memories. He says the worst are the people who have the money but not the memories, and now they have the regret. So I'm trying to walk that fine line here with the secure retirement income process and the concept of fund numbers, secure income, minimum dignity floor, see-through portfolio. So let's jump to see-through portfolio because that's the next dialogue and the next email. And about how much time do we have, Chris?
10, 15 minutes, probably.
Okay, we'll get a little bit into this. We'll probably wrap up with it if Paul doesn't next week be able to do the EDU show. If not, we'll jam this in probably on a Q&A show to wrap it up or extend out the EDU show one more week. Who knows? It's our show. We can decide what we'll decide the day we sit in front of the microphone. So he says, Dear Jim and Chris, this email just came in a few days ago as part of our dialogue series. I've been listening to your podcast for many years now, and it is definitely one of my favorites. Well, thank you. Many thanks to all of your tips, insights, and explanations. I am a Fidelian engineer. So he's not a Vanguardian, folks. He's a Fidelian. So he has his money at Fidelity, most likely a do-it-yourself investor. And he said, if you don't believe me, I have the spreadsheets to prove it. So I'm sure he's got the spreadsheets, you engineer types. Y'all have, and you don't have to be an engineer. You just have that engineer mentality. You love your spreadsheets. Okay, he does give a hint. We had this hint before for California, has the lowest and highest points in the U.S. Want to take a guess what state he lives in real quick?
Well, California, because you said it, but I knew that because we did it before.
I didn't say. I said he, did I say? This, whatever.
Yeah. Isn't it California?
It is California, yeah. But how did you, whatever. I think I did say, did I say we had this hint for California? What's, oh, yeah. All right. So I wasn't thinking, folks, but it is late in the evening. Okay. He says, one of the more important concepts I adopted from your approach was your see-through portfolio. And I use it as part of the funded ratio. Now, I know, Chris, you are more familiar with the funded ratio than I am. So I'm going to let you address some of it. If we don't have time today, we'll get into it. We will continue. I'll get through his email, I promise. He said, is the funded ratio. I use that ratio as a key metric for my retirement planning. So he's kind of going to take our approach, but use also the funded ratio. He said, I have made a few changes to your approach. And he says, here's what I like about your concept of the see-through portfolio. So before I go any deeper, some of you might be sitting there and not quite understand it. Again, we're going to cover this in a lot of detail over the coming series of EDU shows. But in short, when I started working with people and helping them find the fund number, we were literally subtracting dollars out. Remember, it's just spending segmented investing. That's what I call the see-through portfolio. It's an offshoot of time segmented investing, or what the industry calls the bucket approach. The bucket approach is based on time. I'm going to spend these, I'm just going to make this number up. It can be anything. The first 5 years, and the second 5 years, and the third 5 years, and the fourth 5 years. Most people segment their spending in five-year increments. I don't know why, but you could do it in three-year segments, eight-year segments, 10-year segments. But that's time-segmented investing. When we were coming up with the concept of the fund number, we had to pull all of this spending, this dollars, out of our client portfolios. And I don't mean because we were managing their money. People know if you listen to us, we don't have to manage your money. You can keep doing that. You want our approach to retirement planning, it's a separate fee. You pay us for it, and you can walk away with the numbers and go manage your own assets. So when I say we were pulling these dollars out of the portfolio, doesn't mean as a firm we were managing their money, but on paper, we were showing them, hey, out of your, we'll randomly use $2.8 million again, because that got me in trouble last time I used $2.8 million, so I'll use it again. I'm a glutton for punishment. So if you had a $2.8 million portfolio, we're going to start pulling out what you need for your minimum dignity floor early in life, your minimum dignity floor later in life, what you're going to need for your aging, and what you're going to need for your LTC, what you're going to need for a pre-funded inheritance, if that's important to you, what you from an emotional level want to pull out for your buffer or reserve. And there's some people who had other categories. Recently, we had somebody share with us they wanted $100,000 for each child to help them buy a house. Well, that's a separate spending we're going to pull out of their portfolio. I use the concept of a toy box. You're going to open the lid of the toy box and look in. Well, when you start to pull all those dollars out, that's the concept of the see-through portfolio. It's spending segmented investing. In the past, literally, we would pull it all out for people, find their fund number, isolate that, and literally, I put all the money right back into their big portfolio and said, okay, now go out and invest it. That didn't work. And I'm glad it dawned on me quickly, this don't work. This is stupid. I removed all the money. We should be positioning it based on the risk capacity of those dollars, which is based on when the spending of those dollars is intended to take place, with an allocation that reflects their risk tolerance. And that's what gave birth to what I call investment positioning and the concept of the see-through portfolio. So that, to me, is the wonderful way to manage a retirement portfolio. And it's the only approach now as a firm we do with our clients. If we're helping them, you don't have to hire us to manage assets. But those who do and are in the distribution phase, we do a see-through portfolio for them. So that's what we mean. And here's what he says he likes about it. He says, the first thing, Chris, every dollar has a job, a use-by date, and a risk capacity. Mm-hmm. That's what I just said.
That's what we like.
Anything
about
you
it.
Want to add to that?
No, that's what we like about the process as well.
Yeah, so great. He gets it. Beautiful. He said, number two, with this, it allows me to build a portfolio from the bottom up for each position and for each dollar. based on those three criteria. Mm-hmm. Again, the job, the use-by date, and risk capacity in his purpose. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I mean by it, folks. This notion, and again, the industry as a whole, does the safe withdrawal rate, the cynic in me, I told you this before, it's because of AUM, assets under management. Most quote-unquote financial planners or quote-unquote retirement planners are investment advisors. And there's nothing wrong with that. But what they're trying to do is gather assets and charge you a fee to manage them. It's usually 1%. Some are higher. Some are significantly higher. Some are lower. Some are significantly lower. But if you average it, it's about 1%. And what they want to do is gather your assets, charge you 1% to quote-unquote manage them. But they need, and what they like about it is it's scalable. Just keep gathering assets, put them in model portfolios, or sometimes they'll even say, we'll find a portfolio design specifically for you. Mm-hmm, sure. It's ultimately going to be in some type of model, whether they manage it or someone else. But all what they want to do is take their 1% and distribute 4% out from you. Now, whether or not, or whatever their quote-unquote safe withdrawal rate is, some will use more, some will use less. Every investment advisor will be different. The cynic in me, again, is saying having one big portfolio is so much easier for them than trying to manage 4, 5, 6 individual portfolios. If Jacob, who I just gave a great shout out to earlier in this podcast, if he was on the show right now, he would tell you, positioning is tough. It's a lot of work for us to track each individual position. And we're trying to use a multitude of different portfolio tracking options to be able to do this for our clients. It's not easy. And he would much rather have, I can guarantee you, just one big-ass portfolio that he can manage with one allocation, 60-40, 70-30, 80-20. But he also knows, like all my employees, that doesn't work. In my opinion, it's not in the best retirement interest for my clients. That having separate positions is going to ultimately allow them to feel more comfortable spending on fun, which is our primary aim, especially during the go-go phase. Because if they can identify and see that their positions that aren't anticipated to be needed for 12, 15, 18, 20, whatever plus years from now are the positions that are dropping in value, but the positions covering and protecting their minimum dignity floor and their fund spending, which are the two positions that in our practice get a investment risk capacity of principal protection, that those dollars are not dropping and they can see it. They can log into their platform and see my minimum dignity floor and my go-go are protected. Wow, the dollars that are dropping are my aging or my pre-funded inheritance or my buffer designed for the 80, 90-year-old me. Those are the ones dropping. From an emotional standpoint, they feel much better. As opposed to wrapping everything up in this murky, big 60, 40, 70, 30, 80, 20, whatever it is, portfolio that you can't track, but is incredibly easy to manage, to take a 1% fee from, and distribute 4% annually from. It is scalable, it's quick, it's easy, and it allows people, investment advisors, to keep just bringing on client after client after client after client. I shared with you all a colleague of mine who stopped doing financial planning recently because, as he put it, it's not scalable and it's a lot of work. And he stopped actually managing assets. He farms that out to a third party who takes 20 or 30 bips, I forget. But they manage the portfolios for him. And he just takes his 1% on top of that. I like this guy. He's a great guy. I don't like his business model at all. But I like him as a person. I just personally wouldn't hire him to manage my retirement. But that is the approach that the industry takes. And you're going to see this constantly. And again, the cynic in me is simply saying they do it because it's scalable, it's outrageously profitable, and it's easy. See-through portfolio is not. Now, you do-it-yourselfers, you can do this, but there's going to become a point in your life you might not be able to. And it's at that point you might want to try to find a firm that will be, and it's not a shout-out to us, I don't care who you hire, but at some point in time, if you like this see-through portfolio concept, you're not going to find an AUM safe withdrawal rate advisor who's going to do it because they can't. They don't have it. They don't have the capability of doing it. They don't have the back office and the technology in place to do that. So do keep in mind while you're doing it yourself, it's great, but be ready. At some point in your life, you're not going to be able to do it and you might need some help. I think we should wrap up there because he has seven more things that he likes about it. And then he wraps up his email. But he ends the ninth thing, Chris, to give you a little hint. He says, our see-through portfolio concept has helped him with the funded ratio. I want you to talk about that in the next show. So we're probably going to do one more EDU on this. So I want you to, because you have a better understanding of the funded ratio. I think Wade Fow explains a lot of it as well, but I want you to explain how the concept of the see-through portfolio, after we get through the other six items he likes about the see-through portfolio, I'll have you chat a little bit about the funded ratio. Does that sound good?
Yeah, we've never talked about that, the funded ratio on the show, but it actually shares a lot in common with our approach. It just might not be as obvious to people. So I'd be happy to talk about how that I think I totally understand where he's coming from. So yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that.
So that said, next week might be a break from this dialogue series with Paul talking about cap gains taxes and wash sale rule on an EDU. And Paul, don't freak out if you're listening. It won't be that bad. You can do it. And if Paul doesn't have the time, we'll do that later. And we'll be back next week continuing with this email. If not, it'll be Paul, and then the week after that, this email, and then into our whole series we want to do that'll take us right up to June, which is what, Chris?
Annuity Awareness Month.
National Annuity Awareness Month, where our intent is not to convince you guys to run out and buy an annuity. If anything, it's to convince you guys not to run out and buy an annuity until the appropriate time. But it's to get you guys to understand the complexity of annuities and the knowledge you're going to need to hopefully keep yourselves from buying a crappy annuity and instead buying a good, or at least good for you, annuity. So that's why we dedicate June to teaching you all about annuities, because it is National Annuity Awareness Month. And I have no idea who created, well, it's probably the annuity industry
I'm sure
who created
it was, yeah.
National Annuity Awareness Month. But so, I think for two or three years now, we have been dedicating June specifically to annuity questions and annuity EDU shows. So if you have annuity questions, send them to us. It's going to be very helpful from now on when you send us questions. If you have a Social Security question, put that in the title, Social Security question. If you have a tax question, put that in the title. If it's a annuity question, put annuity question. And the reason is I'm starting to store these, Chris, in folders specifically identified: tax, annuity, process, meaning our retirement planning process, investment. I got all these little categories now. So it'd be very helpful, folks, if you could do that. That way I can find, I want to talk about an annuity question or an IRA question. It'd be helpful in the subject line. If you just kind of give us a hint what your question's about, that's I can drag idea. It to the right folder.
Yeah, nice. Well, thanks everybody for listening. And thanks those of you who sent in emails that we could discuss on the dialogue series here. Only works if you guys do that. So thanks for that. If you want to send in your questions like Jim prompted there, you send them directly to him, to his email, jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And put the in the subject line that it's a podcast question. And then as he asked, add the focus of your question. Would be very helpful for him. So little little change from our normal spiel there. Thanks, Jim. Have a nice evening. I know it's kind of late. Go eat your dinner. I'll go do the same, and we'll be back with everybody next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.